Thelema, Coast to Coast, Show 31, August 12th, 2006. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow and I'm the host of the show. Today is August 12th, and that is the Thelemic holy day of the Feast for the Prophet and His Bride. So I want to wish all my listeners a happy feast day. Although most likely you'll be getting this after the day of the Prophet and His Bride. But nevertheless, I hope you had a very wonderful and joyous feast day. Before getting into the podcast, want to remind everyone there are four ways to contact the show. First is via email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. The website is www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. The show voicemail is at 206-600-4216. And of course, the postal service, Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, 30065. And since I just gave out the postal address, I want to remind everybody that if you send in a postcard to the podcast, in return, I will send you a Thelema Coast to Coast bumper sticker. You can see a picture of the bumper sticker on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Also, I've just recently updated the website with about a half dozen cards that were sent in. So if you want to go check them out, that would be great. Also, Bjorn, the card that you sent in did not have your address, so please email me your address so I can make sure to send you your sticker. Also, anybody who sends a postcard into the show, please include your address on the postcard so I'll be able to send you your sticker. And then also a message out for Kenneth in Dallas. Thank you for your email. I accidentally deleted it, though. If you would be so kind to please send it again. Now, there are a few other places on the web to find Thelema Coast to Coast information. Those with MySpace accounts might want to go and friend the Thelema Coast to Coast MySpace. It is at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast. Also, there is a Thelema Coast to Coast Frapper map. It has about 330 people on it right now. You can get to that by going to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and clicking on the Frapper map and adding yourself. In the last podcast, Keith418 was talking about confrontation and the lack of it in the Thelemic community. That resulted in a large amount of feedback, and I think that's great. I'm going to read a few of the emails that I received. There were too many to read them all. I think these do an interesting job of kind of representing the majority of the emails that I received. The first is from Tay. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. First of all, I want to say that your efforts with the podcast are a tremendous help to the Thelema community, and I believe will definitely promote a current of change. Your dialogue with Keith418 is valuable, and despite a minor flirtation with hubris, wink wink, I appreciate the clarity, sanity, and reason which you both represent. Regarding the issue in the community, I think you hit the nail on the head in the earlier podcast when you discussed people's ideology and the lack of realizing they have one. I see that idea as the crux of most issues. Admittedly, it is difficult to expect the will to cater towards an ideology. However, the will retaliate against such efforts with the relentlessness of the sea. Time after time, my castles of sand will experience their inevitable entropy. This process can potentially result in pain and even insanity. Crowley was crystal clear about the difference between black magic and the way. I believe people often undercalculate the type of sacrifices it takes to, quote, rise in a straight line, close quote. The major sacrifice is typically the very ideology we hold on to. Crowley said, humble yourself before yourself. Those who attract weakness will disperse, and the true adepts, who may be few, will endure. But your efforts to share some light on these subjects is much more effective than doing nothing at all. So thank you for your work. Loves the law, love under will. Tay. Thanks for the comment, Tay. I think these all go together. The ideology that we're talking about that often has to go is coming from more a normative society that is confrontation averse, that doesn't want to make sacrifices. We can see that today in how we're having a war on terror. But the country, unlike previous wars that was asked to make sacrifices during our wartime efforts, we're asked to do nothing but go out and shop and consume more. So we're not really making any kind of sacrifices. We're not asked to really participate. The war on terror and the war in Iraq are really kind of academic. They're almost like reality TV. People don't, they're not experiencing these things. And this is all kind of underlying normative society and what Thelema kind of challenges. So I think you're correct that people try to make their will cater towards the ideology, and ultimately the will, which is informed by a transcendent reality, is going to supersede any kind of particular ideology, especially ones given by normative society. So thanks for that comment. The next one is from John. He says, hey, John, I love the show. Thank you so much. You are doing a great service to the Thelema community and the rest of the world. I've downloaded a few of your podcasts, and I think they're awesome. I've been more inspired to carry on with the great work. I've started studying more often, and I'm doing my Libra E exercises more often. I will download more podcasts as my bandwidth permits. Yeah, South African service providers. Sigh. Your show has helped increase the size of the flame within me. Could you please see if you could have a show discussing the essay Beresheath? I'm currently studying it and would be interested to hear what you and Keith418 have to say. Thank you, John, and thank you, Keith418, and everyone who's participated in the shows. John from South Africa. I'll have more to say about this, but actually we are going to have a show in the near future, probably in the next two shows, that will be touching on some of the aspects of Beresheath. But I'll get into that in the closing segment. So thanks for the email, John. I appreciate that. I'm glad you are doing your Libra E exercises and doing more of your practices, and the podcast could help you get motivated. The next email is from a Freighter DMT. 93, John, I just wanted you to know that your show has helped me out a great deal with my magical path. I've been studying Crowley for about 10 years now and got into his work because of the book Hammer of the Gods. I noticed that in your interview with Eric Davis, you said that this book is a sort of gateway to the occult. Well, that is true for me too. In the past few years, I slowly became stagnant in my research and practice, and with life in general. Your show has restarted my drive to do the great work. I also thank Keith418 for doing the Thelema community a great service by putting the fire directly under the ass of slothful types like me. So thanks, Keith418. I would like to hear more from him about the Goetia and some lectures on ceremonial magic. I've recently made contact with the Sora SD lineage of the AA, and think you helped me make that link in an indirect but very real way. Keep up the great work, John. 93, Freighter DMT. Well, thank you very much. These kind of last two emails represent kind of a series of emails that I've been getting lately, where people have been saying how the show has kind of inspired them to get out and doing work and looking at aspects of the Thelemic community that they haven't addressed before. Some people are joining the OTO and other Thelemic organizations presented on the podcast, and I think all of this is wonderful. Thelema is ultimately about doing. It's about the process of becoming and manifesting the will. And so that requires a lot of action. You can't sit and pontificate about the will and do nothing. It's all about action-oriented manifestation. And so I'm really happy that the podcast has been able to kind of get people moving in that direction. So please keep the emails coming. I got one more feedback. It is from an OTO brother and he wants to talk about the aspects of confrontation in the last podcast.
Hey, John 93. This is Pavel from Las Vegas. I just wanted to add on a little bit to the conversation on confrontation. As Keith was saying, if someone is being a pain at an OTO event, you can't really just come up to them and say, stop that, you're being annoying, because they'll simply respond, well, I'm doing my true will. And the only real solution to that is to say, do your true will while you're at home or not here. And while you're at the lodge or wherever, you have to act like a normal human being, which puts you in the ironic circumstance of saying, pursue your true will, but not at an OTO event if it's not within the confines of social norms. So I'm not sure what the solution is, other than to say that at an OTO event, you have to submit your will to the will of the lodge to have an orderly meeting. And it's just maybe the true will concept is not compatible with, you know, confrontation, as Keith was pointing out. I just thought I'd add that on. Great show, love hearing Scholar, and look forward to the next one.
Thanks for the voicemail. I really do appreciate the voicemails. I'm going to have to disagree with you, though. I don't think that they're actually incompatible. The reality is that doing your will requires, as Crowley says in Magic Without Tears, about 90% of Thelema is discipline. And if you're going to be active with the OTO, then you have to conform to the regulations of the order. And this means conducting yourself in a certain way. If you're doing your will and you want to do only your will, that means you have to discipline yourself to not do a myriad of other things. If you're going to be a great painter, that means you have to paint. And that means you're going to have to work at painting, and you're going to have to practice it and discipline yourself to sit for long periods of time painting and doing all the things that are associated with painting, prep, drawings, various things. Paintings are not just going to appear themselves. You have to work for it. You have to discipline yourself. And while you're doing that, you can't be doing a bunch of other things. You can't be going out and running around and traveling and this and that. If you're painting, you must be sitting and you must be painting. And the same thing as being with the OTO. If you're going to be at an OTO event, then you must regulate yourself in accordance with the OTO regulations. Now, if you say it's your will to be in the order, well, then that means you have to accept the responsibility of doing all the things and disciplining yourself to be in congruence with the regulations. So it's not against the will for someone to say, well, you have to sit down and behave yourself. Now, if somebody is at the OTO and they say, well, it's my will to take drugs and be crazy and act inappropriately during the mass or something like that, well, then you have to point out to them that they are incorrect about one of two things. It is either their will to be there, and if it is their will to be there, then they need to conform to the environment, or if it's their will to act the way they're acting or could be acting, then they need to do that elsewhere. And that they're having a conflict of understanding their will, and they need to go resolve that, and they should go resolve that elsewhere and stop bothering people. So really, it's not that difficult. It's all about discipline, and it's all about responsibility. So I hope that has helped kind of clear up some of those ideas. If someone says, well, it's my will to do X, and that X is conflicting with their larger will, then there may be a misunderstanding of will, and people may have to point that out. Okay, so that is the listener feedback. Please keep them coming. I received a whole bunch of other ones, but it would be very time-consuming to go through each and every one. So please keep them coming. One of the newer projects that I have is I've had a personal blog on the LiveJournal system for quite a while, and that has been had a security level, so it wasn't publicly available. I have since created a new public blog for myself. It can be accessed at www.thelema.nu, that's .nu. And that is now my personal public blog where I write a lot about these ideas of Thelema. I'll also be posting notices about the podcast and so forth. So I encourage people to go and check out what's there and comment and so forth. Also on the right-hand side of the website, you'll see a place where you can enter your email address. And whenever I post something to the blog, it will send out a notification. So If you're interested on what I'm saying and to find out quickly, go there and put in your email address. Also, there's a place where you can register on the website. That registration is unique to the blog, and it has nothing to do with the notification. It's all about if you want to reply that you're a user on the system and you don't have to enter your name and email address and everything every time you want to reply. So those two systems are disparate. And then lastly, I do have an RSS feed on the site, and I've also specifically made an RSS feed for those who are on LiveJournal so that they can friend that RSS feed. There is a link to it on the www.thelema.new website. So I encourage everyone to go check it out. On today's show, there are two different interviews. The first is with Keith418, and we're going to be talking about dissent in the Thelema community. There's been a lot of controversy lately about a number of people talking out about the OTO and the way that the leadership is operating, and this has stirred a lot of issues up. This podcast has been part of the controversy, and people have been saying a lot of different things about it. So Keith418 and I talk about that in this interview. And then after that, I have a 40-minute interview with Christopher Penzek. He is a Wiccan practitioner and author of a number of books published by Red Wheel Weiser and Llewellyn Books. And he and I talk about some of his books as well as elemental magic and other ceremonial magic aspects. So people have been asking for different kinds of content on the show, and this is someone that I think can talk a little bit more about the ceremonial aspect. And in particular, I wanted to talk to him about some of the directional elemental aspects, and he and I spent some time on that. So as I said, the first interview is Keith418, and then the second one is Christopher Penzek. So here's Keith418.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John, thanks for having me.
There's been a lot going on the internet right now talking about some policies of the U.S. Grand Lodge leadership. And they have released a number of statements recently, both on the U.S. Grand Lodge website and on the blog of Sabazia's, things relating to some unanimity of the SGIGs, as well as how the SGIGs can function within the order in dissent. And there's a lot of discussion about dissent. What are your thoughts about what's going on?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, one of the people who's been, you know, kind of characterized as a dissenter is, you know, one of your former guests, Alan Greenfield, I believe that's you know, he's been on the show before. And Alan and I have known each other for a long time. I had a lot of respect for his work on the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light, which I think is really good. And some of his writing about the history of witchcraft as it relates to Crowley, I think is pretty much peerless in its field. And I would highly recommend that your listeners go out and read it, because I think it's very good. But that being said, Alan and I have gone on it hammer and tongs over the years, and he's called me all sorts of nasty names and has been, you know, very, very caustic in his dealings with me. And this is true for some of the other so-called dissenters that we've seen coming out. And I just find it sort of unfortunate that the OTO leadership is so insecure and so timid and sort of torn up about itself that Alan's criticism of them bothers them this much. I mean, I personally would feel awful if I took Alan's opinion seriously enough to feel bad about them. And when any authority clamps down on dissent or gets its you know, panties all in a bunch about somebody saying something about them that's not complimentary on LiveJournal or on the internet, then this shows that they're not very strong leaders. And, you know, if it turns out that Alan and the other people that they're angry at right now have really gone and done terrible things that we don't know about, it's still a problem for the leaders, because the leaders put Alan in charge to begin with.
Right.
And this is the thing that I think people may be missing now. If you don't like Alan and you think he's done a bad job and deserves to be booted out of the OTO or whatnot, then you also have to go back and read the essay that Sabazia's himself published not once but twice in Agape, and your listeners, even if they aren't in the OTO, can go access it via the OTO's own website, about responsible sponsorship. Now, you know, if Sabazia's himself is setting a bad example by sponsoring and promoting bad people that he later has to boot out because they're saying mean things about him online, then that doesn't reflect very well on him and his leadership.
Well, and I think this is something that people are missing. This is a lose-lose situation for the OTO and the leaders all the way around.
Right.
And it's not, you know, it's not just, oh, these are the bad guys and these are the good guys. The good guys made a series of really serious screw-ups, and we have to not only examine those screw-ups and those pathetic failures, but also look deeper into why they made them in the first place and what's wrong with them that they would continue to lurch from crisis to crisis, as one Grand Lodge member told me today. That's how he characterized it, the lurching from crisis to crisis, and that's sort of what the OTO seems to be doing to me.
Just for informational purposes, as of this time, Alan Greenfield has been suspended from the order.
Right.
And there is a process of a grand tribunal investigation into the circumstances, and the result may be that he is expelled from the OTO.
Right.
In fact, recently the Grand Master Sabazius put a message out on his live journal speaking about how a SGIG can dissent and things like that, but if a SGIG does dissent publicly, it undermines their positions, and they feel that at this time an SGIG cannot remove themselves from their positions, that once they're initiated to the seventh degree, that they are ipso facto a bishop of the EGC and a SGIG, and those positions cannot be removed.
Right.
And that's what they're saying with Alan, and therefore, if he is resigning from those responsibilities, then he has to cease his active membership. But the problem with that is it doesn't match the history of what some of the OTO leadership has done in the past. I know of at least two scenarios where seventh degrees have had their SGIG and EGC privileges removed by Grand Lodge, but they did not have to quit or remove their active membership.
Yeah, I'm familiar with those too, and I think that they may have either forgotten this or they may be in such a tizzy and a tither over Alan, kind of late in the game too, that they've forgotten this or not thinking clearly about it. I hate to say this, but these are not the smartest people in the world. None of them impress me as having like really logically thought this through. It sounds good, it sounds reasonable, but when you really start to examine it and look at it closely, it's not good. It's not impressive. It's not very intelligent. And you know, again, if this is new policy that they're making now because of this crisis, I can see it having some really negative effects down the line. I mean, first of all, why should they care what Alan says? I don't understand this. If he wants to dissent, if he has a different opinion, and he's saying, I'm going to resign from these active positions, I still want to stay in the OTO, and here's my dissenting opinion, why should this bother them? If the mere act of his resigning all of these positions bothered them so much, why didn't they start this procedure to boot him when he resigned?
Yes, it's been a number of months ago.
Yeah, a number of months ago. And I guess my kind of feeling about this is that the OTO was once proud of the way that it handled dissent. I was always impressed by the way the leaders blew off criticism and just shrugged it off and said, okay, you know, say what you want. We don't care. We're moving on. And that was always my attitude, that the OTO's leaders were forthright Thelemites, that once they made up their mind, they were going to go forward, and if you disagreed with them or you know, you got on the Internet or anywhere else and started complaining about it, they just ignored you because that wasn't what was going to influence them, that wasn't important. So the fact that they now seem really sensitive and sort of like, you know, crying little girls about criticism online, that seems to suggest to me other weaknesses. And I think that's the problem. It's not...
This problem goes on more than just for the SGIGs. There's also been some other policies or directives released recently that for 6 degrees, too, they cannot dissent in public, and doing so will be actionable upon them. So this is a larger issue of just it's not the 7th degrees and that the
right.
initiation
but are,
of the 7th.
Are they also looking at why the people they promoted into these positions are dissenting? Are they also looking at the fact that their perhaps terrible management style is prompting this kind of dissent to begin with? I mean, at my old job, there would be occasional office rebellions at the various branch offices that we had, which wasn't surprising given the nature of the work and the people who were there. But one of the things that I noticed over and over again was that after there was an office rebellion and the people rebelling either quit or were fired, usually quit, the director of the office where the rebellion occurred was fired and was encouraged to leave. Because the idea of upper management was, if you let a rebellion like this go on in your office, you've either promoted the wrong people into positions of authority, you haven't managed your office well, and a mutiny and a rebellion is evidence not only of the bad character, perhaps, of the mutineers and the people rebelling, but also of poor management. And this is what I think people are missing about this current fracas. The personalities and complaints and dissent of the characters are really unimportant. The fact that it's happening at all is pointing to terrible management on the part of the leaders of the OTO, and it's been getting worse and not better. So that's something that I think we need to look at. Why won't they manage well? Why are they providing an environment where these sorts of things go on?
What I think is interesting is the amount of attention and power given to the critics. If the OTO really had a very strong program, something that was very serious, purposeful, had goals that people were really into, that could rally behind, they really wouldn't care what the critics say. They'd be too busy seeing the things that are going on around them, that what they're doing, that they would have something really meaningful and purposeful and serious that they would be dealing with, and they would say, whatever, they're just a bunch of naysayers. We've got this significant stuff going on. Right. But when that significant meaning is lacking and all people have are personality and the petty little projects that get initiated on the local body level, then there's really not that much going on, and they end up starting to concentrate on personality conflict, on various ideological positions, and they get into the gossipy mode that, you know, the leadership has complained about.
Right. Well, I don't know if you've ever watched, friends of mine groan when I use this comparison. I don't know if you've ever watched any of the Nanny 911 or the Nanny Super Nanny shows, but these, you know, child behavior experts will come into a home with troubled children and try to fix the family's problems. And they'll point out to the parents that children cannot just be let to play by themselves. They have to be directed. They have to be given tasks and chores. They have to be helped and given activities to do. And if just left to their own devices, the children misbehave and create havoc and vandalize and do terrible things. Well, you know, I hate to make the comparison, but it sort of seems obvious to me that all of these problems are happening because there isn't enough to do in the OTO. The upper degrees aren't being given a whole series of tasks. There isn't that purposefulness. There isn't that seriousness. There isn't that accountability. There isn't that goal-oriented momentum. And consequently, you know, people start causing trouble. And I don't think that if any of these dissenters were burdened down with projects that were immediately important and urgent and moving forward in a good direction, that they would have time for this kind of dissent. And one of the things that you'll notice from reading what the dissenters are saying is that they felt the leadership withdrawing from them. They wouldn't enter into communication. They wouldn't listen to them. They wouldn't initiate communication or give them jobs to do. And consequently, they felt more and more alienated to the point where they started this open dissent. And that was the point that pushed everybody over the edge. And now we've got this very ugly situation.
One of the things that I've noticed is a lot of the administration supporters right now are saying things like the dissent itself and the criticism itself, or even the medium like LiveJournal or blogs or maybe even this podcast, that these things themselves are damaging for the OTO. When I hear this complaint, I think, well, what is more damaging really? Is it the criticism and the problems that the critics point out, or is it the actual problems themselves? Because the critics point to some pretty serious things, some pretty bad behavior by various OTO officers over history, some pretty serious issues that the leadership really should be engaging in, and they're not. So I wonder really what is more damaging, the criticism or the problems that the critics point out?
The medium of the criticism is really interesting, too, because both of us seen this whole LiveJournal is hurting the OTO and, oh, the Internet's bad for the OTO. And every time people say this, I keep thinking of some medieval Roman Catholic monk raging against the printing press because it's letting evil ideas sink into the heads of people. And
right.
this sort of Luddite-like response to the Internet, look, the Internet is making trouble for all authoritarian cult groups. It's making trouble for the Scientologists, which, you know, if you basically have studied the Internet since it first really appeared on the scene, the Scientologists are fighting a war against the Viet Cong on the Internet. I mean, it's like an insurgency that's really guerrilla-like in approach, and it's been going on for years. The Mormons have suffered because of the Internet, because they're a hierarchical organization with secrets that they're trying to protect, and they're very, very unhappy about Internet criticism. Well, is the OTO one of these old Aeon patriarchal groups that's terrified of criticism and has to have like an absolute sort of agreement that has to be enforced with fear? Or are we the kind of people who are so strong we don't care about our critics and we don't care about dissent? We're moving forward. We have a a program and projects, and we have things we're doing. So when our leaders act like scared little girls pooping in their panties over criticism online, you just have to think, what kind of thelemic leaders really are they? And how did it get to be this bad? I mean, I'm just ashamed when I see our leaders freaking out over really kind of stupid criticism that they should just ignore. So, you know, if you're opposed to the dissent and the criticism, which I think there's many people with a legitimate position on that, then they have to ask themselves, why do we care so much? Why don't we just assume that smart people are going to look at what Alan has to say, dismiss it as being unreasonable or ridiculous, and move on? Why does the OTO have to empower him by engaging at this level of hysteria?
Well, do you think it represents poorly on the administration of U.S. Grand Lodge that one of their SGIGs, in fact, the first one that U.S. Grand Lodge created, is poo-pooing the administration? Do you think that reflects poorly on them?
Well, it sort of does, but it also their counter response is worse than the criticism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, you know, yeah, there's probably some problem for them there that they need to be real men and women about and go look at. And I guess my disappointment is the lack of accountability on the part of the leaders. You know, you didn't promote Alan Greenfield into a position of authority. I didn't promote him into a position of authority. The people who promoted him into a position of authority have to start asking themselves, why did we make this decision, and why did we create an environment where this sort of dissent is causing us as many problems as it is? And they don't want to do that. They want to be authorities, and they want to have all this power and, you know, ability to squelch dissent and to keep everybody in line. But when problems occur, they don't want to be accountable for them. Absolute power implies absolute accountability. And that second part of the equation, they are not man and woman enough to be accountable for. And that's the problem.
Well, I think it's larger than that. I think Thelema is about personal responsibility.
Of course.
And when people don't take responsibility for their actions, whether that be their decisions to promote people or their responsibility for dissenting and accepting the consequences of it, then really, are they Thelemites?
Well, look at the whole path of mediation nonsense that the OTO has tried to foist off on us. I mean, I go on record as I just think this is a torturous document. I deplore it. I think it's unhelpful and silly. But regardless, in that document, there's an expression, when you point the finger at someone, three fingers point back at you. Well, if the OTO is pointing the finger at these dissenters, then we have to wonder what three fingers are pointing back at U.S. Grand Lodge. And if you're going to use this mutual culpability argument where both sides have to look at what they did wrong when they want us to resolve our problems within the organization, then the leaders have to start asking, what did we do wrong? What have our mistakes been? If they want to know, they can listen to the podcast, because we're here to tell them.
Right.
If they want to start stepping up to the plate and being real men and real women and taking accountability for their own actions and their own responsibility, you know, we can help them with that, and we can show them, you know, what mistakes they've made. But I think one of the big problems is that these are not people who are strong enough to admit to challenges and mistakes, and that's part of their anger at the dissent. The other thing I think people should look at is, in the past, a lot of the people dissenting against the OTO, and this is still true, tend to be crazy people. Not just ex-members who are clearly insane, but people who are never in the OTO, who hate Aleister Crowley and are attributing all sorts of things to the order. We've dealt with this for years. And that kind of dissent, the dissent from purely crazy people, doesn't tend to bother anyone too much, because it's easily crazy. It's anyone walking into the room or coming online and looking at the web page can tell within 2 minutes that the person writing it or saying it is crazy. So that doesn't bother anyone. What tends to bother people the most is well-reasoned, rational, calm, logical criticism. And that, at the same time, paradoxically, is what the leaders claim that they want. And what I've found is that the more logical, the more calm, the more reasonable you are when you make your arguments, the more hostile and unhappy people are when you make them, because they're not easily dismissed. And that's when they start backing away. And I think, you know, Alan's criticism has elements that are fairly reasonable sounding. And that's the thing that I think that they're most upset about. It's not the, you know, the betrayal and blah, blah, blah. It's more that he's actually given them some things that are not easy to answer and not easy to pass off. And I think we'd see far more tolerance for the dissidents if they were nuttier.
Well, they say that there are two things that people can do if they disagree. They can quit quietly and go away, or they can quit and protest and do this big flame out and then go away. In either case, they want the dissenters to go away. And what they really dislike are people who stay and continually dissent and criticize and do it rationally with legitimate arguments.
Right. And the worst thing is when those people are right. I mean, that's the worst thing. If you tell somebody not to do something and they go ahead and do it, you've committed the ultimate crime because you've committed the crime of being correct. So that's the absolute worst thing. I mean, no, it's really sad to me because I kind of expected better from the leaders. I expected them either to be tough enough not to care if people dissented, or, you know, really courageous and adult enough to look at their own mistakes and admit their own responsibility. And I had never seen them do that. I mean, very rarely will they take accountability for their stupid mistakes. And usually, if something goes wrong, it's everybody else's fault. And I'm sorry, but with this absolute leadership that they're insisting on, there's less and less wiggle room when there's a crisis. Precipitated it.
I confronted a OTO leader recently about, you know, making false statements. And the leader came back and said, well, at the time, you know, I realize I made false statements, but it wasn't my intent to deceive at the time. And that just strikes me as really kind of foolish. I mean, if you're a leader, it's not us to determine what your intentions are. All we can go on are the facts of what you're saying. Is X true or X false? And if you consistently make statements that turn out to be false, it's kind of hard to take you seriously then, whether it's your intent or not.
Right. Well, there's also this sort of very strange kind of withdrawal from reality that, you know, I think precipitates a lot of these problems, and that's kind of it. You know, I'm not accountable for legitimate mistakes that I make. Well, yeah, you are accountable for legitimate mistakes. If you say things that are not true and act on them, you're accountable for making that mistake, and you have to go back and look at why didn't I look at the truth? Why didn't I have the facts at hand? Why was I so quick to make this bad decision? Why weren't my facts in order? Those are things you have to go back and examine. And every time we catch them making a mistake like this, they don't want to go and do that.
No, I mean, privately they might say, oh, yeah, I made a mistake. And then if we say, okay, well, then you owe so-and-so an apology, they never turn around and do it. They never even go to the other person that they've, you know, made the mistake against and say, we're sorry, or we acknowledge that we made a mistake and not even say they're sorry. They
right.
just let it go. And
right.
that's what builds up a lot of resentment from a lot of people.
Right. Well, again, I think everyone would be more forgiving of these sorts of scenarios if they saw the organization moving forward rapidly with serious purpose and urgency. And you're willing to cut people a huge amount of slack. But, you know, as a friend of mine said, part of their problem is that they will insist on military-style discipline and insist that the organization is a military order when it suits them to, like in this dissent case. But then they'll turn around when it suits them and insist that it's a fraternity and that, you know, strict demands are unreasonable. It really, they bounce back and forth between these two models based on what they want and what they, you know, is most convenient to them. So, for example, they say, oh, you know, this is a military order and you're under military discipline, so you can't dissent against us online. Oh, then it's a military order. But when we ask, well, why won't you make everyone pay what they're supposed to pay in local dues, and why won't you step up the demands on people, especially the leaders who aren't paying local dues? Oh, it's a fraternity. We can't make people give more money. That's horrible. How could you make such an unreasonable demand? So I don't understand why demanding that people not talk bad about them online is a legitimate thing, but, you know, making people pay local dues is not. It's craziness. And no adult is going to respect this. I mean, no serious adult. If you're approaching the OTO like an SCA game where it's all pretend or play on some level, then I guess you can talk yourself into believing a lot of this. If you're taking it as a serious adult religion that's very, very important, then this sort of games playing and double standards, it's just insulting.
Well, I think that's a good discussion of where things are right now. As things progress, I'm sure we'll revisit this and discuss it more. And I would encourage people to go to the U.S. Grand Lodge website, take a look at the recent statement of solidarity from the SGIGs for the Grand Master Sabazius. Take a look at Sabazius's LJ, and also if they're interested, take a look at my personal blog at www.philema.nu. So thanks again for being on the show, Keith.
Oh, thank you for having me, Jeff.
93.
I hope everybody enjoyed that conversation I had with Keith. It's a very pertinent issue right now, talking about when it's appropriate to speak out about various aspects of the Thelemic community and when it's not. And I'm sure this will be an ongoing debate. So this is part of that discussion. Moving forward, as I said earlier, Christopher Penczak is a author and a practitioner of Wiccan witchcraft. And he talks with us today about elemental aspects of magic and how he's incorporated that into his system. And also talks about the various books that he's written. And then lastly, we also talk about gender issues within magic, and in particular aspects of sexuality, physical gender, and identification of gender. So here's the interview with Christopher Penczak.
We have on the phone with us Christopher Penczak. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
Thank you so much, 93. Blessed be.
For those who are not aware, you've been writing books about occultism and witchcraft for many years. When did your first book come out?
The first book, I believe, came out in 2000, and it was written actually in 97, I think, is when I submitted it. So it's interesting for all us aspiring writers out there. A lot of people think you write a book and it comes out right away, but you can write something and not have it come out for quite a few years.
Well, we actually had an interview on the podcast with a former editor for Red Wheel Wiser, and he made it very clear, like, on a quick book is 18 months.
Right.
So 3 years
is... Michael Conlon.
Absolutely.
Oh, I love Mike. He's a great guy.
He is. He's a great guy, and it was wonderful to have him on the show. He gave a lot of information on what it's like on the inside.
I bet.
So Red Wheel Wiser was your, or Wiser was your first publisher?
Yep, Wiser was my first publisher when I started, and in the midst of the first book coming out, they became Red Wheel Wiser.
Okay.
Kind of transitioned from there. So I put out three books with Wiser. It was City Magic was my first, Spirit Allies was my second, and Gay Witchcraft was my third with them. But that was actually my fourth book to come out.
Okay. And your publisher is Llewellyn?
Yep. Well, actually, I'm pretty much a free agent. I can take my books wherever I want and whatever publisher I think is best. But right now, I've been working most closely with Llewellyn.
Okay. And your newest book about to come out in about a month, or I guess a month and a half, is called Mystic Foundation?
That's right. That's right.
And what is that book about?
Well, you know, it was really a book that I was writing for a group of my community and really my clients that weren't involved in a lot of occultism. I found that I had a lot of beginning students who didn't necessarily want to take my witchcraft classes, which I really see as the more serious teachings where I get into more of the magical theory and the daily meditations and really kind of giving you a broad base of metaphysics to understand how the world works in a witchcraft context. And I really felt that a lot of them had the preconceived notions. You know, you run into a metaphysical store, an occult bookstore, or, you know, an herbal shop, and there's a lot of strange things that are in there, and there's a lot of strange books, and there's not really something that's a primer for people who are just starting out. And I had a lot of students within a short period of time that were really kind of questioning, and they weren't necessarily interested in witchcraft per se, but they were interested in the ideas that were kind of around me, involved in healing and meditation and magic in general. So I really wanted to write a book that kind of spoke to them. So the book is really the basic foundations of metaphysics. It gets into a lot of ideas of personal energy and how to control and protect and to shield your personal energy. It gets into meditation. It gets into some magical theory of understanding your place in the universe and how the universe operates, how to manifest, how to develop psychic ability and intuition. And then it really culminates with an idea of explaining what traditions are, what the use of magical traditions and lineages come from, and then it goes through various traditions and explains a little bit of their theology and kind of gives you a little taste of different traditions so you can might read through it and say, okay, now that I have a basic understanding of some metaphysics, I want to study ceremonial magic, or I want to study alchemy, or I want to study witchcraft, or I want to study in mystical Christianity, whatever it might be, that we touch a little bit on almost all the mystical traditions.
So it's kind of a survey book.
Yeah, it's a survey, but it definitely has a practical aspect to it. There's a lot of exercises in there. So if somebody wants to just, you know, have an experience with something, I'm a big, big believer in direct experience.
Okay.
I don't really want anybody to say, oh, just believe this because this is the theory or the theology. I want you to have an experience with it, and if it works for you, then that's great, and if it doesn't, that's fine too.
All right. Another book that came out earlier this year was Instant Magic. What is that?
Instant Magic was an expansion of a little section that was in my Inner Temple of Witchcraft class. And a lot of people, a lot of serious occultists find it hard to believe and think, oh, I don't buy these books. But probably the people who make their living off of writing books and being in the metaphysical world really focus on doing a lot of spell books. And a lot of us who are serious about magic really don't tend to get the spell books because we want the theory books and want to know how to do things. And I really wanted to kind of have a compromise because quite a few people who are interested in my work and have come to see me speak and take my classes really found the witchcraft books a little too thick, a little too serious, a little too kind of dark and scary for them, even though they're really not, but just, you know, really judging a book by the cover and how it looked. And a lot of them were kind of looking for and went for the traditional spell books. So I wanted to write a spell book that could serve the needs of people who were just starting and were interested, yet at the same time got a little bit deeper into spirituality and get a little deeper into theology. And it really was based on my first experience with spellcraft. The real first time I learned how to cast spells and witchcraft classes was about really instant magic. It was really about this, you know, how to change your immediate reality, how to get into a quick, easy meditative state, how to do basic physical healing through breath work and through energy work, and how to really, you know, change your environment in very simple and very easy ways that don't seem all that spiritual, like getting a parking space when you're at the mall or, you know, guessing who it is when the phone is ringing, kind of sharpening your intuition in that way. But all those little experiences start to get you to a place of realizing how everything is connected and how you're connected to a greater pattern in the universe, and everything that you do can affect that universe, and everything the universe does around you and everybody does around you can affect you. So rather than kind of give a recipe and spell book, it's really a book that teaches the technique of how to figure out what do you want to accomplish. What are the various ways of doing it? How can you tune into the forces of the universe? It might be visualization for some people. It might be affirmations and kind of magical words and chants for another. Others might petition a deity or a saint or an angel or a fairy being or something like that. And there's just a lot of different methods of tuning into magic in the moment and trying to bring a magical spirituality into every moment that you have. So I wanted to kind of do a what seemingly looks like a very light book and very easy book, but at the same time, you know, really have a deeper spirituality to it. So people, once they start reading it and think, oh, this is a book that will solve my problems, they can, you know, get some lifelong skills that will change their life and really help them out in the future.
Well, one of the things I noticed in what you're saying is you kind of use magic and witchcraft interchangeably.
You know, for my practice, my magic is based in witchcraft, and I identify as a witch. But, you know, I really see witchcraft as kind of a much larger calling to the priestess and priesthood. I think you can perform magic and not be a witch. But I think most witches that I know and I train are involved in magic as a part of their spirituality. I think when I'm not speaking to a group of witches, I tend to use the term magical spirituality.
Okay.
Well, I don't necessarily see them synonymous, and I know there's some witches out there, and Wiccans will say, you know, you don't have to do magic to be a witch, but for the way that I've experienced it and the way that I teach it, I think it's a pretty integral part of it.
Well, how did you get into witchcraft? When did you start with your magical practices?
I actually, right after high school, I actually ended up going to a Catholic school all my life and really went into it as a skeptic. I had a friend of mine who was really an older mentor and first boss, and it was really just a great person in my life and really attached to my family. And she slowly came out of the broom closet to me about being involved in witchcraft, and little by little, and then finally she kind of just came out and told me. And I thought at first she was joking, and then once I realized she was serious, I thought she was a little crazy. And the more we discussed it, the more I realized that maybe there was something there that I wanted to know more about, but I still thought she was a little nuts, because I was really coming from an academic, scientific background, and if you couldn't, you know, see it and prove it and bring it to a lab, then it couldn't quite be real. And she was very much involved in maybe what we consider to be fringe science and quantum physics and holographic universe theory and things like that. So she was able to present things to me in a way that, you know, really made sense to the scientist aspect of it. And then she invited me to a ritual, and I had a very, very powerful experience with that, and that was very amazing. And I started to study the tarot with her and started to study basics of meditation and basics of ritual, and just kind of got to a point where she felt that she taught me all that she could, because she wasn't that far along, and sent me down to her teacher, who was a woman named Laurie Cabot down in Salem, Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
pretty well known for her books and some of her political action. And that's really how I got my foundational training. And then from there, really got involved in healing and the healing arts and kind of branched out from witchcraft to try to understand broader metaphysics. And, you know, really, to me, I have a very wide definition of witchcraft, and I really see when you're working with the earth and the sky and you see divinity as mother and father and god and goddess, and you're working magic, and you honor the ancestors, and you honor the elements and nature, and
you know, work with the three realms of the heavens, the earth, and the underworld. I think that's some form of witchcraft, even though most people wouldn't call it that. You know, you can be a Native American shaman and you wouldn't consider yourself a witch, but I think there's a lot in common with that. And that's where I see my spiritual kinship. I really tend to look at things from a broad world perspective and what are the similar truths that many magical spiritual traditions hold. And that's the strands I try to kind of weave my own tradition from in my own personal practice.
Well, you've got a number of books that kind of approach these subjects in a different way, and I guess you map them to the elements, your various temple series.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it's a series of five books?
Right. It's actually three are in print right now, and the fourth is going to be in production soon. I'm in the midst of writing the fifth.
Okay. And which ones are out, and which elements do they map to?
The first one is called The Inner Temple of Witchcraft, and that's for fire. The second is called The Outer Temple of Witchcraft, and that's for earth. And the third that's out is called The Temple of Shamanic Witchcraft, and it's for water. And the other two that will be forthcoming next fall, in fall of 07, will be The Temple of High Witchcraft, which is for air, and then The Living Temple of Witchcraft, which will be for spirit.
Okay.
And if all goes well and I don't go mad before then, I'll be doing a tarot deck, too.
Oh, excellent.
Try to kind of bring together the teachings of the five books in a pictorial form.
Why did you start with fire?
You know, well, I really kind of based it, the way I learned witchcraft wasn't the traditional kind of Gardnerian, Alexandrian, you know, here are the tools, here's the ceremony, here's how you cast spells that a lot of my peers have gone through. Going into it as a skeptic, the kind of training and teaching that I had was, you know, here's the magical theories, and here's lighting the inner spark within you, and here's to see vision. And a lot of the things I learned as witchcraft, I think a lot of people learn in basic metaphysics and learning how to visualize, learning how to open the third eye and do psychic work, learning how to astral travel, learning how to speak with spirit guides. To me, that was all very witchy, and it lit an inner flame, and it really got me in touch with my will. They were all very psychic initiatory experiences. Like, once I had them, I realized that I was different and that I could connect to things, and everybody was connected to these things, but if you really focused on them, you could really change and transform yourself. So for me, I think if I started with the traditional earth, here's the wheel of the year, and here's how to do ritual, I know my very, very first rituals in witchcraft, even though they were profound for me, they were profound because they had results, but the actual experience of it was really kind of mundane for me. Coming from a Catholic background, it seemed a lot more like that kind of ritual and structure. I'd go from that ritual and say, you know, people would say, can you feel the energy? Could you hear the voice of the gods? Could you do this? Could you do that? And I'd be like, oh, no, we're just standing around in robes. You know, I didn't feel anything profound. When people say, can you feel the energy of the rock? Or can you feel the energy of whatever ritual tool? It took me a long time to feel energy. And a lot of the exercises for fire and a lot of the things that I really first learned as a foundation from my teachers was about how to sense energy and how to feel energy and how to open that inner light. And I think that was really important, because then once I had that, I could go into ritual and be like, oh, I really can feel this, and I can really see it. And when we call the elements, I feel a presence. And when we call the deities, I feel a presence. But up until that training, I always just felt it was kind of ritual and felt a little silly in my robes and felt a little silly calling down to the moon because I didn't feel anything. And once I had that training, I could feel things. So I have a lot of students that kind of mirror what my experience has been. And, you know, I have a lot of students that are skeptics, and I have a lot of students that have difficulty with psychic ability, or if they have a really great psychic ability but don't really know how to control it. So I think the first level is really kind of getting those energies under control and opening to people who need to be opened up and calming down the people who need to be calmed down before you start doing spellcraft and ritual.
Okay. Now, the one that's coming out now is Temple of High Witchcraft, and that's associated with air?
That's associated with air. That'll be coming out next year, fall of 07.
Fall of 07.
Yep.
And that one is probably your most ceremonial magic-based?
Definitely. Definitely. Almost all the lessons are based on one of the spheres in the Tree of Life. It really goes through each of the spiritual experiences. It's a very deconstructionist point of view on magic. I think a lot of witches are highly influenced by ceremonial magic, but a lot of them don't want to admit it, or a lot of them are ignorant of it and don't really know a lot of the ties between early Wicca and ceremonial magic. So what I really wanted to do was talk a little bit about the history of that and kind of show some of the practices. You know, a lot of people think if they call out to the four quarters and, you know, yell out to the guardians of the watchtowers of the East, that, you know, that was an ancient witchcraft tradition, but that has such a tie into ceremonial magic, and a lot of witches don't realize that. So I wanted to get a little bit more educated about that and to be able to educate my students. Pretty much all these five books are based on five classes that I teach. So I'm just really trying to put the classes into book form. And then what we do through the different lessons is that we look at the different rituals that are available through ceremonial magic, the things that have kind of become standards, and we try to, you know, really analyze what are they doing here, how are they doing it, now learn how to do it. But if the symbolism doesn't necessarily work for you, what's the symbolism theologically that works for you? Like a lot of witches have a hard time with ceremonial magic because of the Hebrew. Although the Hebrew is very powerful, if you shudder every time you hear the Hebrew, then you might want to do it in Greek. You might want to, you know, have a translation or a different version of it in Gaelic, if that's if you're coming from a Celtic tradition. But the idea of the banishing rituals, the idea of the invoking rituals, they all have a certain power to them. And even if you choose never to use them, I think it's a really good part of the witch's training to understand how these rituals work, because so many witches are really intimidated. They pick up a ceremonial magic book and they think, oh, this is high magic, this has nothing to do with me. But I think when we really start to think about theurgy, I think witchcraft has a lot to do with theurgy, the idea of, you know, really communing with the divine and communing with the higher self, the higher soul, the holy guardian angel, whatever you'd like to call it. And I think a lot of witches miss out on that aspect of the spirituality because they're intimidated by the text.
Well, you
they just want to give them a primer so they can look at these different texts and not be intimidated.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the Tree of Life. How do you approach elemental magic within this book?
Within the Temple of High Witchcraft?
Yes.
Well, I have to say I take a page from Jason Augustus Newcomb, who's a great guy, and we've developed a bit of a friendship. And I don't follow always the standard Golden Dawn elemental association. I do put earth to Malkuth, but I put water to Yasod and air to Hod and fire to Netzach. And then we kind of go through and climb the tree, and each of the spheres is a lesson, and we talk about I talk a lot about the visions and the virtues and the vices, and really trying to get into the idea of the spiritual experience of it. But we also get into the correspondences and the tools of each, and there's a meditation and path working based on each of the lessons.
Now, I can understand that particular arrangement on the lower part of the tree, but can you explain why you're doing that and why you're deviating from the particular Golden Dawn?
Well, for me, it seems like the strongest symbolism coming from the Golden Dawn was to match the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh elemental correspondences. But before I really got into ceremonial magic, a lot of my witchcraft training had a deep planetary influence. And to me, the planets, when you look at the moon, that just really screams much more water to me. And even when we look at the way that I pathwork to Yasod, that's just much more watery to me, and the astral foundation. And when I think of the language aspect of Hod, that's just much more air to me. So, you know, I have all these prefaces and warnings for a lot of the traditionalists in the book, saying if you're looking for a traditional book in Kabbalah, you've picked up the wrong book, and here's the ones I recommend. But, you know, this is really what seems to make the most sense to me, and when I teach other witches in the Tree of Life, that tends to work the best for them. So I think a lot of it's been trial and error, and I'd say out of all the classes I've taught and out of all the temple books that I've written for these five books, this was probably the hardest one, because it was really trying to reconcile, you know, a tradition that's not necessarily mine, even though I've studied it, and I really admire its influence upon my craft and upon my magic, and wanting to honor that, and wanting to use the ways that I've applied it to my life, but also kind of keeping in mind that the ways I've applied it might not necessarily be the ways that traditionalists would look, or even other people have applied it.
Now, when you said that you have moved the various elements to those spheres, what directions do you put them in?
Well, that's interesting. When I teach circle casting in a traditional witchcraft context, it was interesting as I got kind of out into the world and got better educated reading more books, because the way that I was originally taught wasn't the way that's standard. Even today, like if I'm at a festival and I'm asked to take part in a larger public ritual, I almost have to kind of flip a switch and rewire myself to, you know, the more traditional associations, because most places that I've come across, particularly the more festivals and public venues I've been doing, start in the east, and they traditionally put air in the east, fire in the south, water in the west, and earth in the north. And the way I had learned it was actually starting in the north and really having this strong point of aligning yourself with the magnetism of the earth and really finding that magnetic north and tuning into it as a part of your rituals. And we actually put the opposites to the opposite elemental correspondences. We'd have earth in the north and air in the south to have an earth-air opposition. And we put fire in the east and water in the west to have that fire-water opposition. And it wasn't until a little bit later, and I really never thought to question my teachers, like, well, why do we do this? And, you know, why is this different from other places? It's just kind of, you know, that was what was done. You go along with, you know, the group as you're experiencing it. But the more I kind of studied and the more I researched, and particularly some of the healing and herbal work that, you know, looked onto the old Greek healing, we talk about the alchemical maps and kind of looking at the oppositions of fire and water and earth and air, and looking at the qualities of earth, and, you know, fire being warm and dry, and air being warm and moist, and kind of plotting that around the wheel, and realizing that was also the cycle of transformation. So when I teach circle casting and when I teach elemental correspondences, I actually believe there's a fluidity to it. I believe as long as you have all four elements and you put them in a direction and call them from someplace, I think the circle can work. I really think the elemental realms aren't literally in directions. They're in a direction that can't be pointed to. I think we put them on that symbolic compass because that's the easiest way for us to comprehend it. But I know I live on the east coast of the United States, and if I'm on the beach doing a ritual, to me it seems kind of weird and silly to put water in the west if the water's lapping at my heels from the east. So I might rearrange it as well. But if I had a choice, I prefer this kind of alchemical air-earth-water-fire opposition. But I know that's different from most places, and I have students that have learned traditional ways and are really about the cycle of the seasons and even the cycle of the day from dawn to noon, and noon should be the hottest point, and so it should be fire, and then west in the water, and earth in the north. But a big point of the Temple of High Witchcraft is that as long as you have a reason to understand the symbolism, and as long as that symbolism works for you, and ultimately as long as you get results, then that's the biggest test. And there's going to be a lot of innovators out there that will do things differently, but if they get results from it, that becomes part of a tradition that gets passed on. If they don't get results from it, nobody else gets results from it, it doesn't get passed on.
Now, are you familiar with Crowley's Star Ruby ritual?
Yes, I am. I'm not intimately in the sense that I perform it regularly, but I am familiar with it. Actually, we're going to be touching upon that a bit in the Temple of High Witchcraft. I actually got permission from, I'm not sure exactly his name, but one of the elders in the OTO tradition that gave me permission to reprint it. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, but within that, it actually it has the opposition that you're talking
right.
about.
And it also has the Widdershins movement, which I find very interesting.
Right. So within your tradition, do you go Diosil or Widdershins?
We go Diosil.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you put...
Although I don't, like, some witches freak out if you do something Widdershins. I think if I was going to do a big banishing ritual, if I wasn't creating temple, I probably wouldn't mind going Widdershins, just from my own theology and from my own kind of... I think you sometimes get programmed with whatever you first are exposed to that seems the most right to you. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of witches tend to freak out if you do anything Widdershins. I think you can do magic Widdershins as well, and... depending on what the intention is behind it, I think that's often the most important part.
So since the listeners of this podcast are primarily Thelemic, what do you say in your book about the Star Ruby?
Well, basically, it's in an appendix. I'm not really, dissecting it or reading great commentary to it, but what each lesson will do, like the Malkuth lesson, will have the Lesser Banishing Ritual in the pentagram, and then the corresponding appendix in the back will say, here's other versions of the pentagram ritual. And, some that I found one and someone gave me permission that has like a very Celtic feel to it. I have the Star Ruby into it. I also have the Star Sapphire for the hexagram rituals. So I show different versions of how people have deconstructed and reconstructed certain rituals and what's worked for them and what's been passed on and what necessarily hasn't. So people can kind of look at that, and if they decide to try a different tradition, they'll have some information there.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't, they can have some inspiration to construct their own.
Okay. Do you address Thelema at all within the Temple of High Witchcraft?
We definitely talk about it in the context of the history of ceremonial magic. And, I think of Aleister Crowley as a huge, huge influence on modern witchcraft. And I know a lot of modern witches don't like to think about that or admit to that. But I think there's that definite crossover with the Gerald Gardner connection. And, there's vast debates amongst witchcraft scholars of exactly what his influence was and what his role was. But I think spiritually, he had just a great influence on modern witchcraft, and specifically that book. When you look at Aleister Crowley's life, I think he's so much of an innovator, and the sense that, he was, even when you take that line, every man and every woman is a star, the idea that finding that direct center of your own solar system, the own center of your universe, being your own light, being your own center, that ultimately you have to figure out what works best for you, and I think he was the best example of that. So I actually hold him up to my students as somebody, to emulate in the sense of you can create your own magical paradigms if you feel called to do that, and look at some of his work to see how he took traditional things and transformed them and changed them and really had a blend of both knowing intellectually how things worked and really knowing his stuff, but also having that spiritual inspiration of he just didn't decide to redo things to redo things, but there was that divine providence, there was that divine inspiration to say this is what's coming through me. And to really have people find their own way, find their own light through that.
Well, you've talked about a lot of your practices in the background and how it was non-conventional in some ways. How do you apply these elemental aspects or the various directions and things like that? How do you apply them to your rituals that you do in the construction of your rituals?
Like the oppositions of earth, air, and fire and water?
Right, and then also the use of the elemental weapons, I'm assuming because of the change you're putting the sword in the east, you're putting the wand in the east and the sword and then the dagger in the south, is that
right.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
So what other kind of modifications do you do to your rituals that incorporate those kind of changes?
You know, honestly, I don't think there's a huge amount of... I think if you went to my ceremonies, you'd notice differences. If you're familiar with more kind of straight-on Wicca, you'd be familiar with a lot of the aspects. I don't think I change things completely radically. But what I think, it does change the energy. Like, people have come to my public rituals in the Boston area. I publicly celebrate the 8 Sabbats, and people are welcome to come to that. It's a bookstore down there that hosts it in Cambridge. And people who have not been to the rituals before really notice a certain intensity to that elemental correspondence, and some really don't like it and never come back, and you know, others really enjoy it. We do a lot of personal transformation work in those in my rituals in general and in my public rituals, and I think that opposition of elements really aids to that. But I still associate blades with air and wands with fire. I know some people have it switched,
mm-hmm.
But I think the great rite I still do with the cup and the blade. Although I've been in ceremonies that we've done it with the wand as well, and I think that has a different energy to it. I don't think it's necessarily bad, but it's not the way I prefer. Again, I think sometimes you're programmed with what you're used to, and you know, when I was first trained, it was the blade and the cup. But I don't think the shifting of the directions alters that symbolism or that feel for me.
Now, when you were mapping the elements to the lower spheres on the tree, what kind of lessons or what kind of things do you touch on in your book about Tiprith and above?
Well, you know, the higher you go, the more nebulous they become, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
I look at Tiphereth as really the spirit aspect of it and communing with your holy guardian angel and really getting to the mysteries of sacrifice. The lessons were much thicker. It was much easier to read, to write after we got to that point because, you know, there's only so much you could say, and the lessons became shorter. The earlier lessons really get into not only working with the elemental weapons, but through visionary work and working with the elemental planes, finding those elemental weapons within. The way the five books of the Temple series kind of work, they're almost like octaves of each other, where 1 and 3 have very similarities to it. 2 and 4 have a lot of similarities. And in the second level, in the Outer Temple of Witchcraft, we dealt a lot with communing with the elemental planes. And, you know, I believe before people should go calling on the elements, they should actually have contact with the elements. And so what we do in the level 4 is now I'm assuming that people have continued those relationships and have been working with the elemental planes. What I really want them to do is then, you know, find within themselves through working with the air teachers that sort of truth. I want them to find the stone of sovereignty or the pentacle of sovereignty. I want them to find, you know, the wand or the spear of victory, kind of borrowing from some Celtic imagery because that really speaks to a lot of my witchcraft, and really finding that holy grail or that cup of compassion. And then once you get beyond that, the kind of ritual challenges were a lot more nebulous. So it was the idea that we commune and do a path working up to Tiphereth. We do a ritual to invoke the Holy Guardian Angel and to commune with it. But it wasn't the same quite a challenge. I actually kind of put a preface in the book that if you can't get through the first four and feel comfortable with the first four elements, then don't continue on with the book until you have that mastery. Then you can go onward.
Mm-hmm.
I really got a lot into Gabura. Gabura, I think, is something that I've been really always struggled with in my life, with the whole Martian energy. So it was really nice to talk about that. There was a bit of relating Gabura to the scourge and witchcraft and the traditions that use the scourge and the idea of suffering to learn, but also the kind of breaking down power. And I think a lot of Kabbalistic sources also look at Gabura as very feminine and kind of dark goddess, destructive war goddess aspect to it, which a lot of people, when they think Mars, automatically assume male figures. So we kind of explored both genders of Gabura. So I had a lot of fun with that as well.
And then when you got to the Supernals, what kind of things did you look at there?
Well, you know, the Supernals are really, in our theology and kind of the witchcraft that I teach, we have this concept of divine mind or great spirit or whatever word you want to have to it, and really relating what was taught in the previous books about that to Kether, and then looking at as divided as, you know, a primal goddess figure and a primal god figure, and looking at Bina and Hokma like that, and really kind of looking at their union and the idea of Hokma being the seed and Bina being the great primal ocean or fertile cosmos, and through that everything coming through. So I really kind of looked at them as that. In fact, you know, you have Tiphereth and Gabura and Hesed, and they were more nebulous than the ones that were before that, but then once you got to the Supernals, that was even more nebulous. It was about having that direct experience. In the end, I think there's a lot of things you can't put into words, but really having people commune with those energies. I know a lot of people say, well, they're above the abyss, you can't commune with them, but if we have our kind of microcosmic tree in whatever sphere we're anchored in at the time, I think you can touch an aspect of Kether. It's not Kether, it's not enlightenment, but you can get a sense of what that energy is for you, where you're at right now.
What kind of rituals did you design with that? Are they more type of meditations or path
working? There are a lot of path working meditations, and I'll bring them through the different paths, and specifically working on the tarot imagery, because the Outer Temple of Witchcraft dealt a lot with tarot, so I felt like this was taking it to the next octave of understanding tarot. And then there's actually going to be CDs that go along with it, and the way I do it in class, and the way I assume that I'll have the CDs, and we're in the midst of recording in a few weeks, will really be about, you know, giving the person a lot of space to experience things directly. So the higher you go up on the tree, the less descriptive I become, you know, just to let people have their own experience with it. And honestly, when I do a lot of path workings, I leave a lot of space anyway, because I believe it's, if I say something and that's not what you see, you know, that's fine. Once you've made communion with the energy, once you've done certain things to connect with it, once you've vibrated the God name, once, you know, I definitely encourage people to light the appropriate incenses and build an altar to whatever lesson we're working on at that time. So it's the colors and the incense and number of candles that corresponds with the same color. And, you know, if it was Yasod, I'll have the 9 purple candles or whatever it may be to really invoke that energy. And once they've communed with it, then just have an experience. And it doesn't so much matter what I say, but what they envision and what they experience is the most important part.
Okay, well, we've talked a lot about the Tree of Life and ceremonial magic, and you've made references to kind of the god and goddess and various genders, but one of the things that is interesting about what you've worked with is you also have a book called Gay Witchcraft, Empowering the Tribe,
right.
And you're very vocal about your sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you see gender and or gender identity versus actual physical gender? How does that work in with your magical practices that you have noticed within your experience and also your students?
Well, you know, I, one of the strange things when I look back on my training and the things that I got from it and the things that I didn't, as I started to kind of go more out in the world, I realized that certain forms of witchcraft, in particular certain forms of more kind of British traditional witchcraft, had more of a gender bias, had more specific roles of this is what a man did in the ceremony, and this is what a priest's role was, and this is what the priestess's role was. And a lot of the training that I had from my teachers were, it wasn't that coven lineage based. It was like, here are the tools that you need, and you can practice in a group, you can practice, a lot of us were practicing solitary, so it was how do you do the great rite alone? How do you enjoin both goddess and god alone? It was really drilled into me in early in magical training that we all have that bisexual polarity current. We all have goddess and god. We all have male and female. We all have yin and yang. And a good witch or a good magician can, you know, really direct which current that they need at that time. So I was never really stuck on specific gender roles. And it wasn't until I went more outside of my immediate community that I started to be faced with that. So my own personal practice, I'd say, doesn't really, not that it doesn't reflect, I think a lot of people think I'm a little bit more vocal about orientation and gender identity than I am, and not that that's a bad thing, it's just that was one aspect of something I felt I needed to bring to light, but it doesn't play a huge aspect in my personal practice. My partner, my husband, practices witchcraft and magic as well, and we'll do rituals together, and although we're doing rituals together, and one may be holding the chalice and embodying the goddess or embodying the god, we're not stuck on those roles. You know, I actually am in a very, I kind of think of it as a very Aquarian coven, and we have rotating leadership and are very avant-garde for most traditional witchcraft covens. And, you know, the role of leading the ceremony of two people and priest and priestess can be taken by anybody of any gender. And the coven's mixed. It's not an entirely gay or lesbian coven. We've got gays, we've got lesbians, we've got bisexuals, we've got straight people, we've got married people, we've got single people, we've got polyamorous people. It's a very kind of hodgepodge. And anybody can take whatever role they want. So, you know, I might be doing a ritual with another priest, and you know, he might be embodying the goddess and be completely straight, you know, and we just don't get hung up on those things. I think it's really important for every man to get in touch with the goddess and the god. Actually, for me, in many ways, it's easier to get in touch with the goddess because I was really running from Catholicism and the image of God the Father. And it took me a long time in witchcraft to be comfortable with the idea of the god, because I think a lot of witchcraft traditions, and even when I started, even though there was an emphasis of goddess and god, everybody's meditations focused on the goddess. Everybody's chants focused on the goddess. Everybody's imagery and visualization focused on the goddess. And the god was just something, well, you had to call on the god, but, you know, nobody really had the deep, direct relationships, or at least nobody was talking about them. And so for me, it was a real challenge as a man and as a gay man to get really in touch with the god energy. I think something that was really pivotal for me was that I was invited out once Gay Witchcraft came out to a gay men's festival in Ohio called Between the Worlds. And I actually was quite nervous to go out there because, you know, one, to have a group of small festivals, really intense pagans and witches and magicians, can be kind of tough. Sometimes the bigger festivals are easier because you can disappear when you want to. And then having a group of it be all exclusively gay and bisexual men, people who identified as queer in some way, was really intense in the sense of brotherhood and the sense of divine masculinity, along with the goddess, but there was a great emphasis of the god as well, was really profound. I had these really deep shifts at that festival to the point where I was just about to go on to speak to give the keynote address, and I really, like 2 hours before, shifted the whole topic of what I was going to talk about, and really talked about the divine masculine and finding brotherhood in a very different way than I was going to talk about it before. And the relationships I've built with those guys, and I actually go back now every year, my husband and I go back for fun every year. It's one festival that I do completely for fun and completely for charity and really help promote, because I just found such a sense of divine masculinity and divine brotherhood there and working ritual. It was really the first time I think I've worked exclusively with all gay men in ritual and really experienced kind of gay men's mysteries. So I think it's important for everybody to explore all gender aspects. I think it's important to really figure out, you know, how you identify, if you identify in a specific way, and to explore all ranges of it. So I think men, straight or gay or bisexual, should explore both goddess and god. And I think different people, different groups of people who identify in a similar way have their own mysteries. I think gay men have their own mysteries. I think lesbians have their own mysteries. I think straight men have their own mysteries and straight women have their own mysteries. I know I had the experiences early on in my craft career that I really wanted to go to a women's circle because all my friends were going to a women's circle and like, you know, you just don't have the right equipment. You can't go. You know, this is for women only. And at the time, I remember thinking that was terribly unfair. But now, after having these experiences, I realize, well, women have certain mysteries that I just don't understand, yet I can be closer with the goddess and experience different things through invoking and through meditating and through working with the goddess. But women have their own mysteries that they sometimes need to explore on their own, and everybody has their own mysteries they need to explore on their own. So it's I don't know if that answered the question, but that's kind of where I'm at with the gender identity and sexual orientation. It's given a lot of my magical thought to kind of early on. The reason why I put Gay Witchcraft together is because there wasn't a lot of books that talked about it, and I was kind of compiling my own little grimoire, talking to people, and eventually someone talked me into the idea that, well, maybe other people would like to see what you came up with.
And what has the response been to your book?
Really good, actually. Overall, it's been really, really good. It was nominated for a Lambda Award, which is a pretty prestigious gay literary award, which really surprised me. A lot of the gay literary world, I think, didn't quite know, you know, what to do with it or what to do with me. So it was interesting to have that response, although the gay pagans that were out there got a really great response from it. And actually, a lot of the best reviews that I've gotten from it were actually from straight pagans, saying that it really helped them understand their coven mates, or to help them understand where their students were coming from, and really recommended it for both gay and straight pagans. So that was really, that was something that surprised me, and I was very, very happy with it. I kind of expected a little bit more of the kind of traditionalist backlash, and I mean, if that's been out there, I haven't quite seen it.
Now, you mentioned not having the right equipment to go to a women's circle or anything.
Right.
Have you run into any ritual situation where not having the right equipment was a hindrance because of certain things that needed to be done, or has it been mostly an energy polemic type situation?
Most of the things that I do, you know, in public, or, well, I'm not really engaged in physical sexual magic unless it be with my partner or someone that I have an already intimate relationship with, so that's never been kind of that physical issue. And I think when you're ever in a public ritual or public space, they make it very clear of, you know, who's needed for what or who's welcome to what, and not in a condescending or mean way, but just that this is the type of mysteries we're going to explore here. So I haven't come across that personally myself.
Excellent. All right. Well, is there anything else you wanted to add?
Well, I have a very kind of strange book coming out, and I don't know if it'll to particularly speak to your audience, but that's the one that's coming out next March between Mystic Foundation and the Temple of High Witchcraft.
All right. What's that?
It's called Ascension Magic, and it's a book that's really kind of bridging a lot of my connections and experiences in the healing community and involved in a kind of a New Age community that people would call the Ascension Movement or Light Workers. And they're really drawing a lot of their theology from theosophy and really trying to bridge the gap between magicians and witches and shamans with this kind of more fringe New Age aspect of teachings and healing techniques, and really show how they have similar histories and how they have very similar techniques, although a lot of people in the Ascension paradigm maybe have different theology or different symbol systems to go on with it. So that's my focus in March, is having Ascension Magic come out and really trying to bridge the gap with that. But A lot of the Ascension folk are really involved in angels, but a lot of the lore that they have for angels is a little bit alien to people who might be Kabbalistically involved in angels. So I try to bridge that gap and talk about different types of both modern and ancient angelic lore. And it's the same thing with people who are involved in fairy traditions. Like, a lot of witches involved in fairy traditions look at New Age fairy traditions and kind of shudder and say, you know, that's not where the tradition comes from, and that's kind of a Victorian era image. So really trying to bridge the gap and talk to people about, you know, where the roots of these things come from, and try to share techniques with both sides of the community.
All right. Now, you have a website and a mailing list. What's your website address?
The website's just my name, ChristopherPenzak.com, and all the info from my mailing list to get, you know, info on when new things come out, new books and new classes are posted, right on there. Just click on mailing list.
And you do classes all across the country?
I do. I'm primarily based in the New England area, and I teach in southern New Hampshire and Boston weekly. But I actually tour and travel quite a bit. I do a lot of weekend intensives across the country, and we're doing a big Midwest tour in October.
Okay, and if somebody wanted to have you at their coven or bookstore or something, they can get in touch with you from your website?
Yep, the website has all my contact information.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time and talking about your books and elementals and things like that.
Oh, it was quite a treat to be able to, you know, talk in depth about some of these topics. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks again. 93.
Blessed be.
I want to thank Keith and Christopher for being on the show. Appreciate taking the time. As I said earlier, the listener who sent feedback asking about Bearsheath, there's going to be two upcoming podcasts that are going to be lectures. Number 32 and 33 are going to be lectures. 32 is going to be from Keith 418, and that is entitled Strategic Planning for Magicians. This was a lecture that he did in June at Therion Babylon Oasis in the Bay Area. And then show number 33 is going to be a lecture that I gave at Dove and Serpent Oasis in July. And it's about Crowley's ontology, and in particular, addressing his document Bearsheath. And I talk about how Crowley saw the universe in an ontological way, and then how he took those ideas and mapped them to his AA system on the Tree of Life using kind of the outline. So it incorporates a lot of the Golden Dawn and also Crowley's ideas that he picked up while studying Buddhism. So that's going to be show number 32 and show number 33, and those are going to come out approximately over the next 4 weeks, probably about 2 weeks in between each one. So thanks for everybody for listening to the show. That brings us to the end of show 31. Again, I hope everybody had a wonderful feast of the Prophet and his bride. The outgoing song is a amusing one. It's from a band called Cakes of Light. The song is called A Real Prince. And I like this song because it's kind of folkish and acoustic and everything. But listen to the words, and it's kind of a funny thing. The way they're singing casually about sacrifice and things like that. It's pretty amusing, and I like the fact that all of these kind of subjects are in kind of a very folky acoustic guitar kind of song. So I hope people like it, and I've linked to the Cakes of Light MySpace on the show notes. So until the next podcast, I hope you stick around. Love is the law. Love under will.
You said that you're a magician. I'll teach second degree. Told her that you had a position in your secret society. Man, the way you're transmitting, I don't think she could see that you come from a long tradition of necromancy. You just wanted to have her. Have her could ever. I open your letter to the crypt with a shiver, wax bloody with pain on your altar. Thousands were littered and started to chant, God bless all of the sinners and God damn all the saints. And now that she finally listened, well, she started started to faint. You just wanted to have her, abracadabra, abracadabra, Isle of Pan, Isle of Pan. Circle around and switch off the light. Picked her up off the ground and called her your wife. And then, without a sound, you stuck in your night. And as she spiraled down, you sucked the life. Just wanted to have her.